Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
I wanted to go to the phone lines for an interview today. We have on the phone here with us, we're going to be speaking with Robert Spencer from Jihad Watch, and we'll be speaking with him in just a few moments on the broadcast. And as we were, I wanted to talk to Robert about his brand new book that is coming out, or is just been released, I should put it that way. But in speaking about this book, let me read to you the opening statement that is made on the, this is right off of Amazon, and the book is called The History of Jihad, From Mohammed to ISIS. And so in this book, it says it's a comprehensive history of the role of war and terror in the spread of Islam. The opening paragraph says this: it is taken for granted, even among many Washington policymakers, that Islam is fundamentally peaceful religion and that Islamic jihad terrorism is something relatively new, a product of the economic and political ferment of the 20th century. But in the history of jihad, from Mohammed to ISIS, Islamic scholar Robert Spencer proves definitively that Islamic terror is as old as Islam itself, as old as Mohammed, the prophet of Islam, who said, I quote, I have been made victorious through terror, unquote. Well, that is certainly an ominous statement there made by the Mohammed. And joining us now is Robert Spencer, who's to talk about this brand new book. Robert's been with me on the Knowing the Truth radio program before. It's a pleasure to have you back on the program today.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, Robert, I wanted to talk first of all about maybe we should define jihad a little bit, just for our listening audience that probably hear that term a lot. But what's a good working definition of it for our conversation today?
Well, the main thing that jihad means is warfare against unbelievers in order to bring them under the rule of Islamic law. That is the main thing that it is defined as in Islamic theology. The word itself means struggle. And there are every kind of struggle, and there is every kind of struggle in Arabic, just as there is in English, small and large. You can have the jihad to quit smoking, or the jihad that is the great civilizational struggle to impose Islam. It's all the same word. But in Islamic theology, jihad is all about subjugating unbelievers under the rule of Islamic law by military force if necessary.
Okay. Now, with that being said then, so that we have a good working definition of jihad, let me ask you then to, I read just a moment ago, just the brief one-paragraph statement from the website about the book, but let me give you the opportunity to give us the gist of the book, the premise of what you've written here.
Well, I've got to tell you, I'm very excited about this book. This, I think, is the crown and culmination of all my work for over 20 years, because there really isn't any book like this. This is the first and only exposition of the entire history of jihad from the beginning of Islam all around the world. In India, there's a great deal of material in the book about the jihad in India that I think is going to shock a lot of people. People don't know this story. All around the world, in Europe, and of course in the United States, this is the first comprehensive history of the entire phenomenon of jihad over 1,400 years, and it has enormous implications for our domestic and foreign policies in numerous particulars. I think that there are many, many ways in which our foreign policy is based on not knowing this history, and I'm hoping this book is going to change that.
Now, we have an impossible task here in a 20-minute left of the interview, you know, but there's 1,400 years that you detail in the book here. If I can ask you to just pick or to give us a little sketch, if you could, of just some of that historical aspect over those 1,400 years, just to give people a flavor of, you mentioned a little bit there with India already, but to give the listening audience a flavor of what they'll find in the book.
Sure. Well, you know, going back to India, there's so much fascinating information that I found and put into the book about the jihad against it, against the Indian subcontinent. One of the things that I thought was extraordinary was that the first entered India as an invader in the 700s, was rebuked by the governor of Iraq, Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, who had sent him. And Hajjaj ibn Yusuf told him, look, you're being too lenient on the people. You shouldn't be accepting their submission and allowing them to live. You should be killing them if they don't convert to Islam. And this kind of brutality characterizes the jihad against India all through. One of the most extraordinary things, in light of the common historical myth today that the great Islamic empires were actually tolerant and peaceful, one extraordinary story that I have in the book is of the 16th century Muslim ruler in India, Akbar the Great, he is known as. And Akbar the Great is extraordinary because he got disenchanted with Islam, and he ultimately left Islam altogether. And when he did, he suddenly relaxed a lot of the laws that were making life difficult for the non-Muslims in India. And it was only because he had left Islam that suddenly he became a tolerant, magnanimous, benign ruler. And his son, who succeeded him, Jahangir, he was disgusted that his father had left Islam. He was an Islamic hardliner, and he brought a lot of those restrictive measures back. And so, contrary to the myth of Islamic tolerance, it was when the guy left Islam that life got better for the Hindus in India, and when Islam was reasserted, life got worse for them.
And we see that pattern of where they go into an area and then, you know, relatively maybe calm initially, but eventually it seems like the jihad comes to the surface and they take what they want by means of terror. Is that the story that repeats itself all throughout history?
Yes, absolutely. The brutality of the conquerors is a constant of Islamic history, and it's designed to make the people who they are attacking so afraid that they ultimately surrender. And that's actually another story from India, is of the Hindu leaders in one city, and they have a meeting as the jihadis are approaching, and they say, look, these people, they're vicious, they're savage, they're brutal, and they're relentless. And we don't stand a chance. We should just surrender now and hope for the best. And that's exactly the point of the terror.
Yeah, I've said before, Robert, that one of the reasons why they use terror is because, and I hope people understand me the right way here, terror works. It's kind of like when you get spam on your computer and you say, why do they do this? You know, everybody just hates it so much and so forth. But they do it because it works. You know, people eventually click on things and so forth. And in a similar way, when I watch what's unfolding with the terror associated with Islam, eventually, if they're brutal enough, if they're just wicked enough to carry out these acts of terror this way, eventually they do get invited to the table. In fact, in our own the negotiating table and the table of acceptance in society and so forth. So in a sense, I'm not advocating it, I'm just pointing out a fact. In a sense, if people are not committed and resolved to fight against the folks doing this terror, in a sense, terror works for these folks. Is that true?
There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it, absolutely. You see it all throughout Islamic history in the book, that groups of essentially bandits, cutthroats, warlords, who invade an area, but they're able to overcome the legitimate government in that area and subjugate the non-Muslims, then they become the respected rulers of the area and ultimately are conferred a legitimacy by those around them. We've seen this in our own day. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, it began as a terror group. It's still a terror group. And it killed Israeli civilians and the Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics
yes.
in 1972, and the world was horrified and appalled. And yet, not long after that, it started to be conferred legitimacy by the United Nations, which now considers it to be it's practically its pet project and is routinely raining down these absurd condemnations on Israel. And the whole world considers the PLO and essentially the Palestinian Authority, which is essentially the PLO, to be the legitimate expression of the will of the Palestinian people and a perfectly legitimate government. And yet, this is a jihad terror group. But this is what happens. The West again and again, and the non-Muslim world again and again, as I show in the book, underestimates the jihad imperative, misunderstands it, thinks that it can co-opt it to its own ends, ends up collaborating with it, and aiding and abetting in its own demise.
Now, we see that from a policy standpoint, and we see the, you know, the capitulation that is made to Islam and so forth, and the type of actions that are carried out where they just deny this, the obvious about these patterns of jihad that have existed throughout these 1400 years that you lay out here in the book and so forth, and even up till today. But for the average person, they say, you know, more on a colloquial sense or, you know, more in the vernacular, well, you know, not all Muslims are interested in jihad. Not all Muslims are like this. And therefore, we can't, you know, with a broad brush, paint all of Islam this way. I would imagine that the point in the book is pointing out that jihad is intrinsically a part of Islam. Some may not be carrying it out to the same extent, but you can't separate jihad from Islam. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And the thing is, yes, of course, not all Muslims are waging jihad or have ever waged jihad. But the other side of the coin is that there have always been Muslims everywhere, every place, all through the history of Islam, who have been waging jihad. And there's never been a let up. There's never been a reformation, a reconsideration, a rejection of the doctrines that lead to Muslims behaving violently toward non-Muslims. These doctrines are still part of Islam, and there are still Muslims acting upon them. And as I show in the book, this is just the same as it has always been throughout history.
People apparently do not understand that history and do not see the pattern that is being set here, because in our modern day, Islam has actually achieved more of a minority type status. And I mean that minority type status with all of the political correctness that goes along with it. So we're almost to the point here now where the terror or the jihad, at least in its overt forms, they don't even need to do that at this point, because they've already infiltrated to such a level here in the United States that people are already sympathetic towards them and so forth, and all of that minority status. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. As a matter of fact, the last chapter of this book is called The West Loses the Will to Live, and shows how the people who are the chief aiders and abettors of the jihad imperative today are not Muslims at all, but non-Muslims who believe in multiculturalism and diversity and so on, and think that this requires them to open the doors of free societies to large numbers of Muslims who are inevitably, there is going to be among those people some who believe that Islamic law needs to be imposed over the new countries to which they're coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just see that as they're coming into the new countries in such large numbers that they then are able to have quite a, impact in the voting block. And then now they're actually installing Muslim community leaders and officials and so forth, who are more and more leaning towards Sharia. Is this where it's going, in Dearborn and other areas of the United States, that eventually Sharia is going to be implemented in these places?
Well, if the current trends continue, then, yeah, there's no doubt about that. The thing is this. The book shows that wherever there have been Muslims and non-Muslims, there's been conflict started by the Muslims and attempts to impose Sharia. Do we really think it's going to be different in the United States? And if so, why? On what basis do our policymakers assume that? There has never been a reformation that has rejected these elements of Islam. The reformations, as I show in the book also, are actually in the other direction. They make Islam more violent and virulent because they go back to what the texts actually say. And the texts do exhort Muslims to commit acts of violence. And so there's no separate understanding of Islam among Muslims in the United States. There's no different Quran. There's no different sect here. So why do we think that it's going to be different here from how it has been everywhere in the world throughout history?
Robert, a lot of people think, well, you know, there have been different terrorist attacks that have taken place, but really not that many when you think about how many Muslims there are. You're familiar with the website there, of course, Religion of Peace, and the keeping track of the number of terrorist attacks that have taken place around the globe. Do you know offhand what sort of number we're at right now since 9/11? How many terrorist attacks have taken place where the person who has done the attack has specifically stated that they did it because of their belief in Islam?
As of this morning, it is 33,503 terror attacks around the world since 9/11.
Since 9/11.
So, you know, when you look at that, it gives the lie to these common myths that people just repeat mindlessly that, well, there are extremists in all religions. Okay, well, where are the Jewish extremists, Christian extremists, Hindu extremists who have committed 33,000 terror attacks since 9/11? It's an absurd statement, but it is very common. And, well, that's another reason why I wrote the book, to try to shatter a lot of these false assumptions and expose these historical myths.
Robert, it seems as if they've learned to use our teaching, our rights about religious liberty against us. Are they very smart in this way, wily, you know, where they're using our own doctrines of religious liberty against the American people?
Oh, yeah. It's very clever, and it's very insidious. Mm. And I have often come against this when I'm speaking or in various places around the country, and I speak about the aspects of Islam that are used to incite Muslims to violence and so on. And I routinely get people saying, well, you know, there is the First Amendment, and the First Amendment makes it so that we can't really do anything about this. We can't infringe upon their freedom of religion. Well, look, the First Amendment is part of the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution is designed not to destroy the United States, but to protect and defend the United States. And the idea that the First Amendment is some sort of a license to commit acts of terror is ridiculous on its face. The First Amendment is not a permission to break other laws. And as long as these other laws exist, and they do, then there is every reason to restrict the aspects of Islam that are at variance, that contradict constitutional principles. Islamic law denies the freedom of speech, the freedom of conscience, the equality of rights of all people before the law, and much more that are basic principles of American law.
Mm.
And so we cannot, if we're going to say, well, you've got the freedom of religion, therefore you can break all the other laws, then, we deserve whatever we get in that case. But the freedom of religion is not actually and never was meant to be some sort of a suicide pill for the United States.
Hmm. I like to remind people that when we think about Islam and they talk about one aspect of it, the religious aspect of it, and they want to just carte blanche give to them religious liberty, I would just remind them that there is a religious element there, there's a political element there, and there's a military element associated with Islam as well. And by granting the religious liberty, you know, just carte blanche to it, we're also granting it to these other elements of Islam as well. Do you believe the same?
Yeah, see, Islam is a religion, of course, but it's also a political system. And it's not just any kind of political system. It's a political system that is supremacist, violent, authoritarian, and aggressive. And consequently, it comes into contradiction, comes into conflict with the political system that is the law of the land here.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to have to be confronted sooner or later. Right now, it's just routinely ignored, and the people who point it out are decried as Islamophobes and so on.
Right.
But this doesn't mean that political Islam is going to go away. We're going to have to deal with it eventually.
Mm-hmm. Now, what does that actually look like? I agree with Trump's ban on travel ban on allowing those that ascribe to Islam to come in from other countries, especially these countries that have a propensity towards violent jihad and so forth. I think that because of these political and military aspects of it, until we get a handle on how do we judge who's going to do this and who's not going to do this, that I think that it's completely right for us then to say that we are not going to allow any immigration of folks from these types of areas that are very prevalent in this Islamic teaching. And that's just something that we should do for the security of the United States. You would say?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree more. The idea that the travel ban of the president is some sort of a racist enterprise or something like that is an idea that people who are not aware of or deliberately ignoring the nature and magnitude of the global jihad, only such people could make that argument. The fact is that the president is trying to keep people out from jihadi hotspots, and that is in service of his responsibility to protect the American people.
Mm-hmm.
The question is this. You have two hard choices when it comes to Muslim migration, two hard choices. One of them is to keep out some harmless people, and the other alternative, and the only other alternative, is to let in some harmful people.
Mm-hmm.
You either keep out some harmless people or you let in some harmful ones. For years, we have been told that we have to let in harmful people because to do otherwise would be racist and bigoted and Islamophobic.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been shamed into allowing these practices that are endangering Americans. And President Trump is, on the other hand, saying, I'm sorry that we're inconveniencing some harmless people, but that is the unfortunate thing we have to do in order to keep out some people who would kill Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's excoriated for that, but those are the only two choices, and he is making the one that is intended to protect Americans from jihad attacks. For that, he deserves our gratitude.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that if people are mad at somebody about that, they should be mad at Islam. They should be mad at the radical allowing this, subscribing to it. There's the point where you should focus your anger, not your anger on those who are merely trying to protect themselves and those under their care or under the responsibility that they have to protect. I go even a little bit further, Robert, than just like the travel ban, but I think that there should actually be a moratorium on the building of any more mosques in the country as well, since the mosques seem to play such an important role in the training of terrorists and so forth, the communication networks and all of these types of pieces. Talk about the role of the mosque in these things.
Well, the thing is that four separate independent surveys since 9/11 have found that 80% of the mosques in the United States are under the control of people who are teaching that the Constitution of the United States ultimately should be replaced by Islamic law and teaching hatred of Jews and Christians. And so these mosques, they deserve to be scrutinized. And unfortunately, there is so much denial about this. There's so much willful ignorance about this. There was a mosque recently, as a matter of fact, last year, this story made headlines way up in New Hampshire, where an investigator went into the mosque in Manchester, I believe it was, and looked at the literature that they had available and determined that this was a very dangerous place that was teaching jihad and so on. And he made a full report. And then the Manchester, New Hampshire chief of police said that it's terrible that there was this Islamophobia in Manchester, and he completely dismissed the report, said that the people at the mosque were fine people and he knew them, and this was all ridiculous.
Hmm.
Now, the researcher, he didn't have any vested interest in making the people in the mosque or the mosque itself look bad. He just was a dispassionate observer of exactly what was being taught there, and that it was waved away as bigoted and Islamophobic by the police chief is a dispiriting indication of how political correctness and willful ignorance rule the day nowadays and hamper our ability to deal realistically with this threat.
Mm. You know, Robert, people are surprised to hear me talk about the idea of the religious liberty here and saying that Islam doesn't deserve to have that privilege. And with the mosque, because they say to me, I come from the perspective, I'm a Protestant pastor, and they say, well, you know, you open that up where the government is now going to be monitoring what's taking place in the mosque, or you're going to clamp down on religious liberty so that the Islamics, Muslims can't have it. You're going to open up a Pandora's box, and then they're going to do the same thing to Protestant churches as well. Well, here's my answer to that is, listen, if Protestant churches were doing what's coming out of many of these mosques, I would be all for having the government clamp down on Protestant Christianity. You know, I'd be all for that if there were people coming out that were committing acts of terror, or if we were teaching about terror in the building itself and encouraging people to rise up against the U.S. and so forth, I'd be all for the U.S. government being involved in it. So I think the case can be made. It's not an apples to apples, and I don't think that we should just everybody gets religious liberty just because they say they're a religion. I think that that we need to ask more questions than that and say, is this something that is pro-U.S. or anti-U.S.? And if it's anti-U.S., we have no business or reason to go ahead, like you said, our own self-destruction to allow these types of groups to populate here in the United States against us. Robert, thank you so much for the work that you do. Thank you for writing this book. And thank you for being with us for a few moments here today on the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That was Robert Spencer, and Robert's book, his brand new book. He's got a number of books out, and all of them are very good. But this is the latest one. It's The History of Jihad, from Mohammed to Islam. I'm sorry, to ISIS. From Mohammed to ISIS. Again, it's written by Robert Spencer. And Robert, when you check out his blog and you know what he does, he's the director of Jihad Watch. And so that's a program of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And when you check out some of the things that he's writing about and saying, I think you'll see the legitimacy and the value that he brings to this whole discussion. I know as we talk about these things, there are things that need to be discussed, and we need to look at them objectively, not buy into the political correctness, but look at them with an objective eye and then judge from there, you know, whether or not they're worthy to be given this religious status. Remember this, the Lord Jesus Christ said, He said, you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth. To keep this ministry strong and coming your way, you can make a financial gift at knowingthetruth.org by clicking on the donate button.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.